Part 1. Where I'm Coming From. Time is like a river that carries us forward into encounters with reality that require us to make decisions. We can't stop the movement down this river, and we can't avoid those encounters. We can only approach them in the best possible way. When we are children, other people, typically our parents, guide us through these encounters. As we get older, we begin to make our own choices. We choose what we are going after, in other words, our goals, and that influences our paths. If you want to be a doctor, you go to medical school. If you want to have a family, you find a mate, and so on. As we move forward toward these goals, we encounter problems, make mistakes, and run up against our personal weaknesses. We learn about ourselves and about reality and make new decisions. Over the course of our lives, we make millions and millions of decisions that are essentially bets, some large and some small. It pays to think about how we make them because they are what ultimately determine the quality of our lives. We are all born with different thinking abilities, but we aren't born with decision-making skills. We learn them from our encounters with reality. While the path I went down is unique, being born to particular parents, pursuing a particular career, having particular colleagues, I believe that the principles I learned along the way will work equally well for most people on most paths. As you get to know my story, try to look through it and try to look through me to the underlying cause-effect relationships. Look at the choices I made and their consequences, what I learned from them, and how I changed the way I make decisions as a result of them. Ask yourself what you want. Seek out examples of other people who got what they wanted, and try to discern the cause-effect patterns behind their achievements so you can apply them to help you achieve your own goals. To help you understand where I'm coming from, I'm giving you an unvarnished account of my life and my career, placing special emphasis on my mistakes and weaknesses and the principles that I learned from them. Chapter 1. My Call to Adventure, 1949 to 1967. I was born in 1949 and grew up in a middle-class Long Island neighborhood, the only son of a professional jazz musician and a stay-at-home mom. I was an ordinary kid in an ordinary house and a worse-than-ordinary student. I loved playing around with my pals, touch football in the streets, baseball in a neighbor's backyard when I was young, and chasing girls when I got older. Our DNA gives us innate strengths and weaknesses. My most obvious weakness was my bad rote memory. I couldn't, and I still can't, remember facts that don't have reasons for being what they are, like phone numbers. And I don't like following instructions. At the same time, I was very curious, and I loved to figure things out for myself, though that was less obvious at the time. I didn't like school. Not just because it required a lot of memorization, but because I wasn't interested in most of the things my teachers thought were important. I never understood what doing well in school would get me other than my mother's approval. My mother adored me and worried about my poor grades. Up until middle school, she would make me go to my room and study for a couple of hours before going out to play, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. She was always there for me. She folded and rubber banded the newspapers I delivered, baked the cookies for the two of us to eat while we were watching horror movies together on Saturday nights. She died when I was 19. At the time, I couldn't imagine ever laughing again. Now, when I think of her, I smile. My dad worked very late hours as a musician, up until 3 in the morning, so he slept late on weekends. And as a result, we didn't have much of a relationship when I was young, other than him constantly nagging me to take care of chores like mowing the lawn and cutting the hedges, which I hated. He was a responsible man dealing with an irresponsible kid. Memories of how we interacted seem funny to me today. For example, one time he told me to cut the grass and I decided to just do the front yard and then postpone the backyard. But then it rained for a couple of days and the backyard grass became so high I had to cut it with a sickle. That took so long that by the time I was finished, the front yard was too high to mow, and so on. After my mother died, my dad and I became very close, especially when I started my own family. I both liked and loved him. He had a casual, fun way about him, the way musicians tend to, and I admired his strong character, which I assume came from living through the Great Depression and fighting in both World War II and the Korean War. I have memories of him from when he was in his 70s, not hesitating to drive through big snowstorms, shoveling himself out wherever he got stuck, and it was no big deal. After playing in clubs and cutting records for most of his life, he began a second career in his mid-60s, teaching music in high school and a local community college, which he continued to do until he had a heart attack at 81. He lived another decade after that, as sharp as ever mentally. When I didn't want to do something, I would fight it. But when I was excited about something, nothing could hold me back. For example, while I resisted doing chores at home, I eagerly did them outside the house to earn money. Starting at age 8, I had a newspaper route, shoveled snow off of people's driveways, caddied, bussed tables and washed dishes at a local restaurant, and stocked shelves at a nearby department store. I don't remember my parents encouraging me to do these jobs, so I can't say how I came by them. But I do know that having those jobs and having some money to handle independently in those early years taught me many valuable lessons I wouldn't have learned in school or at play. In my early years, the psychology of the 1960s U.S. was aspirational and inspirational, to achieve great and noble goals. It was like nothing I've seen since. One of my earliest memories was of John F. Kennedy, an intelligent, charismatic man who painted vivid pictures of changing the world for the better, exploring outer space, achieving equal rights, and eliminating poverty. He and his ideas had a major effect on my thinking. The United States was then at its peak relative to the world, accounting for 40% of the world's economy compared to about 20% today. The U.S. dollar was the world's currency, and the U.S. was the dominant military power. Being liberal meant being committed to moving forward in a fast and fair way, while being conservative meant being stuck in old and unfair ways. At least that's how it seemed to me and to most of the people around me. As we saw it, the U.S. was rich, progressive, well-managed, and on a mission to improve quickly at everything. I might have been naive, but I wasn't alone. In those early years, everyone was talking about the stock market because it was doing great and people were making money. This included the people playing at a local golf course called the Links, where I started caddying when I was 12. So I took my caddying money and I started playing the stock market. My first investment was Northeast Airlines. I bought it because it was the only company I'd heard of that was selling for less than $5 a share. I figured the more shares I bought, the more money I could make. That was a dumb strategy, but I tripled my money. Northeast Airlines was actually about to go broke, and another company acquired it. I got lucky, but I didn't know it at the time. I just thought making money in the markets was easy, so I was hooked. In those days, Fortune magazine had a little tear-out coupon you could mail in to get free annual reports from Fortune 500 companies. I ordered them all. I can still remember watching the mailman unhappily lugging all those reports to our door and me digging into every one of them. That was how I began building my investment library. As the stock market continued to climb, World War II and the Depression seemed like distant memories, and investing seemed like a simple matter of buying anything and watching it go up. It would certainly go up, the common knowledge held, because managing the economy had developed into a science. After all, stocks had nearly quadrupled over the past 10 years, and some had done much better than that. As a result, dollar cost averaging, in other words, investing essentially the same amount in the market every month, no matter how few or many shares it could buy, was the strategy most people followed. Of course, picking the best stocks was even better, so that's what I and everyone else tried to do. There were thousands to choose from, all neatly listed in a few pages in the newspaper. While I liked playing around in the markets, I also loved playing around with my friends, whether in the neighborhood when I was a kid, using fake IDs to get into bars when we were teens, or nowadays going to music festivals and on scuba diving trips together with my friends. I've always been an independent thinker, inclined to take risks in search of rewards, not just in the markets, but in most everything. I also feared boredom and mediocrity much more than I feared failure. For me, great is better than terrible, and terrible is better than mediocre, because terrible at least gives flavor. The high school yearbook quote my friends chose for me was from Thoreau. If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away. In 1966, my senior year in high school, the stock market was still booming and I was making money and having a blast, cutting school with my best friend Phil to go surfing and doing what fun-loving high school boys like to do. Of course, I didn't know it then, but that year was to be the stock market's top. After that, almost everything I thought I knew about the markets was proven wrong.